Hi, this is Tracy Stivers, the archivist for Cincinnati State Technical and Community College, and today I'm going to be interviewing Debbie Bogenschutz, who's our coordinator of information services here at and Johnny Mayberry Library. So Debbie, first off, I'd just like to say thanks for participating.
You're quite welcome.
Okay, and I'm going to ask some introductory questions.
Okay.
Okay, just tell me your name. I know we already stated that, but your name and date of birth.
Debbie Bogenschutz, January 26, 1951.
Okay. And when did you begin working at Cincinnati State?
In January of 1980. I think it was the third that year, but I haven't looked it up.
Okay. Okay, now I'm going to ask you some questions about policies and culture, okay?
Okay.
Can you just describe the hiring process? What was it like when you started here?
Oh, it was hideous. We've always had these group interviews here, but I swear my group must have been 10 people. We were in the library conference room. It was a bunch of people firing questions at me. It felt like taking oral comprehensives. And in those days, to ensure that everybody got asked the same question, got the same information, nobody got a leg up, if the interviewee asked a question, all the rest of the panel could do is repeat the question they had asked you. So they asked some question and I says, are you talking about something like a so-and-so? And they would all just look at you and read the same question to you again. And if you said, so are you thinking about developing a program that would do so-and-so, they would just read the same question to you again. Things have gotten a little bit better, but we still basically use that group interview method. And then it was like ages. And I got a letter in the mail, which, you know, you get the letter in the mail, you're assuming it's going to say thank you, but we hired somebody else. And it's the thank you, we'd like you to call us and tell us when you want to start.
Huh. So they didn't call you and offer you the position?
They didn't call me and offer me the position. They sent me a letter offering me the position, and I had to call them and tell them whether I wanted to accept it or not.
Wow.
Then I got here the first day, and I said, so where do I go? And they said, oh, I guess you would like a desk. I said, yeah, desk would be nice, but we're not quite as bad as first days as we used to be either.
Okay. Can you describe the culture of the college when you first started here? I know you mentioned it a little bit already.
It was a technical college, so it was very different than what it is now. We just had the single building, and the main building wasn't as big as it is now because it used to be more of an H shape and they started filling in holes of it through the years. So it was a much smaller operation. We had about 3,000 students. I don't know how many people worked here, but everybody knew everybody. You know, you would run into everybody. The cafeteria was up on the third floor, and I regularly had coffee in the morning with another member of the library staff, a member of the media staff, the vice president for finance, and a janitor. I mean, you know, you don't have those kinds of groups getting together like we did in those days. It was just a whole different world.
Right.
The students were older. I had no experience with a two-year college or a technical college, and it was pretty much culture shock from going in from a four-year college. And the library was so limited. There were so many areas that we just didn't have books about. We didn't have literature. We didn't have history. We didn't have philosophy and religion and the arts.
Because you had worked at what?
I got my first job as a student worker when I was in college at Thomas More, Office of Philosophy major. And then when I graduated from there, I got a job as a reference assistant at Northern Kentucky University. And in between, I did a small limited project with Procter & Gamble and couldn't wait to get back to an academic institution.
Okay, so what do you think has changed the most throughout your years here at Cincinnati State?
Just the continued growth. We became a community college, so we started, you know, adding a whole bunch more students, different kinds of students, more and more people. We've now have two buildings besides all the areas that they added on to this building. Everybody doesn't know everybody anymore. I mean, you know, you it used to be much more common for somebody from health, somebody from the library, somebody from engineering to have lunch together, or, you know, and now people huddle in their own little groups a lot more. The committee structure is still a representative of this area, that area, and the other area. So you do have more opportunities to mingle there than you at some places yet.
Okay. To talk about the process you went through to secure tenure here, because your position is a tenured position.
My position is a tenured position. In those days, you had to survive for 7 years without getting fired. They would give you your new contract, which had a little box check that says tenured instead of the previous ones, and it'd say untenured. Jim Horton was the library director at that time. He shook hands with me and said, congratulations, you now have tenure. There was no process like there is now. That started with the first AUP contract, where you actually had to get together a portfolio, demonstrate your value to the institution, to your department, to your profession. We didn't do any of that. We just had to survive without getting fired.
Right. And you said it was 7 years?
7 years, uh-huh. I think it was 7 years.
Okay.
I think it was 4 when the union came in, but then you had to do a lot more work for it.
Okay. Cincinnati State has witnessed a tremendous growth in terms of campus size as well as the student body. How did that affect the institution and more specifically the library?
Well, you had to make more room for people. When we became a technical college, when we quit being a technical college and became a community college, we added like history and literature and the arts and all kinds of fields that the library didn't have to collect. So the size of the library had to just about double, just based on the kind of books that we were buying. And when we were a technical college, pretty much you would get a new book and you would throw out an older, outdated book that was replacing. We weren't growing exponentially like we are now. At the same time, the library physically has not grown at all. When I came here in January of 1980, the library had been opened about 6 months. Johnny Mayberry, who was the first librarian who the library is named after, had designed the new library, and that was pretty much her swan song. She retired. I don't know if she worked in it at all, but she had retired already by the time I was coming. And apparently she was taken by surprise pretty late in the process to find that the library wasn't going to get 100% of the space that she had designed to be part of the library. This department was going to borrow this, and this department was going to borrow that, and we have never gotten all that back still. We've lost additional space. There used to be a separate media department where the media collection and all the televisions and projectors and all that stuff were stored. That all came to us, and we just had to find room for it while we were physically losing space rather than gaining space.
Okay. I'm going to ask some questions about the library. Just talk about your job responsibilities here and, you know, how they changed from when you started to now.
When I came, IBM hadn't made a PC yet. It was a whole different world. The catalog was an old-fashioned card catalog. The periodical indexes were the print. You got a bound volume every year, and it was updated every week, month, depending on what the database was, with little thin paperback magazine kind of indexes. We had a vertical file, which was the most current awareness thing. You would read the newspaper and cut out articles and categorize them and put them in the vertical files. We were already at that point in time an OCLC library, so we were getting our cards produced through OCLC library. We weren't sitting down and typing them out like you did in the old days. But we would still get card sets in the mail that, and everybody helped with the file. It wasn't all the cataloger, you know, different. Somebody had a light load, the cards were stacking up, I'd go file cards for an hour. We had not done interlibrary loan at that time yet, and that was one of the things that I was hired to do, to initiate an interlibrary loan program. We were part of the Greater Cincinnati Library Consortium, which became the Swan Libraries later. It's a consortium of basically the college and university libraries, the public libraries, a couple of corporate libraries in the area, and we would share our books with each other. And, you know, we had a way of when we would literally call each other and say, do you have this book, can we borrow it from you? But besides the cataloging use of OCLC, to me as an interlibrary loan librarian, it would let me see that the University of Nebraska or whoever had this book that I wanted from my patron. And in the beginning, we typed up a three-part interlibrary loan form and mailed it to them. Eventually, OCLC had a format online where you would fill out the form through the OCLC system, and so it didn't waste 3 or 4 days in the mail before the book wasted a week in the mail getting to you. So we were able to give people, or, and at least know, I mean, sometimes you would send a form away to a library several states away, and a week later you get the form back saying, sorry, in use. And eventually the OCLC system got to the point where, first of all, they would be able to reply, you know, the next time they check their files, usually the next day, sorry, that's in use. And eventually you would be able to see before you had even initiated the request to them that it was in use, so you didn't waste time like that. Eventually you could put in a string of institutions that held the book, so if number one said, we can't lend it, it would automatically go on to number two. So you weren't really sure where it was coming from when it got to you. But it sped up the process a lot. That was interlibrary loan. Another thing that I was hired to do, which was new to Cincinnati State, was dialogue searching. In those days, the databases were pretty much held centrally. And you would use a dumb terminal, wasn't even a computer, to log into, most of the services were in California, and you would log into whatever index you wanted to use, do your search, get your periodical citations, your book citations, whatever kind of information you were looking for. You paid a $15 an hour communication fee, plus a fee for the database that you were using. The cheapest ones, like ERIC, was the Department of Education Index, was $15 an hour. Patent search might be $200 an hour, depending on what you were looking for. And you paid by the minute. So the kind of thing that any college student now goes up to a terminal, starts finding that information. The faculty member would come to me for that information, and it would cost, you know, a minimum of $5 to $7, I would think, and often $25, $30, $400 to get that information for them.
Okay. Discuss your role in building the library collection and services.
Well, the library that I came to was very, very small. Originally, the college, this was before my time, but the college and the high school that was the original tenants of this building had a shared library in what's now the Writing Center upstairs. The high school was gone by the time I got here, but there hadn't been a tremendous amount of books in the library. I don't know what the holdings were at that time, but we had a lot of empty shelves, and now we've continuously added more and more shelves. We taught business technologies, health technologies, engineering technologies, and there was your basic English, psychology, sociology classes, math, science supporting those. But, you know, there were so many areas that we just didn't collect because we didn't buy those kinds of things. My background was in philosophy. I had always been a liberal arts kind of person. I didn't have any engineering background. or health background or business background. So I had to start reading best books kind of books and checking against our collection, doing some ordering from that, start reading reviews that would come with a science journal or whatever, to start buying the books. We have always encouraged the faculty to make suggestions, and we overwhelmingly buy, I'd say 99.9% of what the faculty suggests we buy. But if we would sit back and wait for the faculty to suggest things to buy, the library would be much, much smaller. For the most part, I had to build it myself based upon what I knew of our curriculum and what I knew of the books that were being published. As we became a community college, we added all the other areas. I've just tried to keep up with all the different fields. Mm-hmm. What was the question again?
Just your role in building the library collection and services.
Okay, and as I said, we didn't have interlibrary loan before I came. I was doing the first dialogue searching. I'm really proud of the bibliographic instruction that we've built here. When I came, every once in a while, an instructor would say, can you come talk to my class about the library? And it got so that more and more classes were saying, can you come talk to the class about the library? We've always done the bulk of freshman comps, but there've always been business classes, engineering classes, classes of a different sort that would say, will you come, especially when the class was requiring a paper, will you come talk to my class about the library? When I built the library's first website, which was also the college's first website, the library had a website for about a year before the college did. At that time, and we had already become a OhioLINK library, we had the online searching, we were starting to get online databases through them, so I made a website to give access to the online catalog, the online databases. And at that time, Kathy Rames, who was the head of the English department, sat down with me and we arranged a plan whereby every freshman comp class would come get the library experience. And that has continued to this day. And, I'm sure that a lot of my colleagues at other places would die for a bibliographic instruction that is as well incorporated into the English program as ours is here. So that was another new thing that I brought. But it's something that we started with in 1980, and then by 1997, 17 years of struggle of saying, please let me come to your class. It finally gets to the point where, and now we're doing the nursing classes, we just added them. We've been doing a lot of developmental education classes, they're calling that foundations, I think, these days. That's what they're going to be calling classes in the semester transition.
And you wrote a grant to get the cyber lab space.
I wrote a grant to get the cyber lab space. Yeah, in the beginning when we started doing that, the Writing Center had a computer lab that I used for maybe 80% of them. But they also taught classes there. So then if there was a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday class at 10 o'clock and there was a class already scheduled in the Writing Center at that time, I had to go beg a lab from business or engineering. And I used to spend the better part of a week for every term lining up my classrooms to have all of this. So eventually some outside library group was in that room and they were vacating it, and I wrote a grant to get the first set of computers. It was for library service to the underserved. And since we were doing DE classes, there's a lot of it, freshman comp, that was hitting, a large population, we got the grant funded to get the computers for the first cyber lab, and that's been, just really nice because we've got first dibs at it for the 3 weeks that we use it almost constantly.
Right, you're not fighting other people for it.
We're not fighting other people for it.
Okay. I think you talked about this a little bit already, but how have you worked with faculty to build a library collection which supports educational needs and satisfies accreditation requirements?
we'd always like to do more. I mean, you know, the only thing you can do is meet with faculty members one-on-one, tell them what, you know, when you start making your comment, your contacts through committee work or through lunch or, you know, where, however you make contact with faculty, to let them know that you're willing to buy what they want you to buy and things. Accreditation has really changed. When I started here, it was very typical of a program that was going up for accreditation to contact me far in advance and say, we're going to be accredited in April. I need a bibliography of all the books that you have in the library that support my program. And we would literally type up a bibliography of all the books we had in the library that supported their program. This was when we were using IBM Selectric typewriters. We didn't even have word processing at that time. So I would, you know, start working when they had it, and maybe a week before, you know, I would have separate information on what we had added since this big document was done, so we could update it at the last minute. But it was literally typing up 20, 30 page, 40 page, 50 page, depending on the department, what their criteria was, bibliographies for these accreditation things. When we first became automated through Innovative, a lot of people would still be asking for that, but in that case you could just, you know, type in a few key subject headings, a few ranges, the computer would spit it out. And most of the time these days, the accrediting team just has access to your catalog so they can search around. We just did a visit for one of the programs a week or so ago, and Cindy Sefton, the library director, and I, and the two gentlemen from this accreditation team just sat down and just casually chatted about what we do, what kind of questions this program generally brings. They just, you know, wanted to see that we did, yes, physically have a library, but most of our journals now are not physically in the library. Most of them are online, and that's what people are expecting, where, you know, it used to be a real energy-intensive process.
Okay. So how has technology changed the way the library serves patrons? You know, you talked about that.
We had no technology when I started. I mean, it was filling out, writing your name on the little card that was in the pocket in the back of the book, and filing them and stamping the little date due on the little date due stamp. And then, you know, just gradually, I, you know, did mention how we progressed from IBM Selectric typewriters to, first we had a Wang word processing thing, which was a centralized word processing for the college. So we would type up our documents, but there were just a handful of printers throughout the building, so we would have to go to an office down the hall to pick up our prints. After we had sent them, we had to go to the computer room up on the third floor to do our backups. They used 8-inch floppy disks in those days. Then we got, IBM started making PCs, and we got one PC that was on a little rolling cart, and it would be like, I'm going to do this project, I'm going to have the PC for a while, and then somebody else would have a project they wanted to do, they'd have the PC for a while. OCLC, we had a wired-in terminal at that time, and we just had a dumb terminal that we were doing the dialogue searching with, and then more and more everything's done with PCs that are more powerful and more more capabilities, more flexibility. But And then, you know, when I got here, the library and the media were all part of a learning resource center. Media was much more commonly 16-millimeter films. Film strips were still in use. Slide programs with a little tape-recorded accompaniment were part of that. I don't think VHS was around when I started here. And then for a while there was the battle between VHS and beta as to which video format was going to win out. And now we still have some videos, but if it's a program still in use, we're replacing them with DVDs as much as we can. And we're getting a lot more digital access to films online. We still have some VHS things that people have been begging me to get digital access to, and every so often I'll contact the distributor, the publisher, whoever, and say, is Program X available yet? And they said, no, that's still on our list, but right now, or they said, no, we're not dealing with that program anymore. So we still have some things that faculty insist are the very best thing on their topic that's available in VHS format, and it's probably going to be available in VHS format as long as the VHS tapes and the VHS units are surviving, which probably ain't going to be forever. But, you know, if we can get things on DVDs and digitally, we're doing that. But those are all new formats. We have never had microfilm here. When they went to periodical storage, they went to microfiche, which is, you know, much more compact for storage purposes. I think that's probably the main advantage microfiche has over microfilm. And now most of the journals too. We still have some microfiche, but most of the journals too are digital online. A lot of them, we have a lot less paper journals than we used to have because so much is digital access these days.
Is it true that the library had the first internet connection in the college?
When we became an OhioLINK library, OhioLINK started as the state-supported four-year colleges. Eventually they added the two-year colleges, state-supported. Then they kind of opened up to private colleges could join. And when we became an OhioLINK library, one of the main things of OhioLINK library is the centralized catalog where all of our resources are shared. So you search in our catalog for something and move into the statewide catalog with just a keystroke. And in order to make that happen, we had to be on the internet. So OhioLINK at that time was arranging for all the two-year colleges to get National Science Foundation grants to bring the internet to their campus. And so we originally had the internet basically for the purpose of the centralized catalog. And then OhioLINK started adding periodical databases that were shared statewide. And they started coming through the internet too. We used, what did they used to call those, gophers? In those days, it was all, you know, you had a list of your six things and you wanted database number five, so you typed a five and the number, nothing was, you didn't use a mouse for anything on the early OhioLINK programs. And then the World Wide Web was coming in, so you had the more visual information, you had the mouse-driven access. In 1997, I was awarded a sabbatical to make the library's website. And so I worked at home on my home computer at that time. I had much better internet access at home than I had here at the college. And I have never been an internet pioneer. I mean, I've never been on the cutting edge of any technology. But I made the college's homepage on my home computer, and when I got back, we, you know, made it live, and the college at that time didn't have, I mean, we were getting phone calls all the time, what's your website address? And we said the website for the library is, but the college doesn't have a website address yet. And that's changed. So now the downside is I had total control over my website in those days. The look of it, the feel of it, what was on it. I could do my own, I did it in HTML. I didn't do it with any kind of fancy programming. And then as the college got more sophisticated in web use, we're just, you know, given a part of the overall package, and our look had to meld in with the general look of the college. I have total control over the library website again now, but for a while I would make my edits. They'd have to go to somebody else to be approved. If they were on vacation, my edits might be sitting in a queue for days. But You know, so there are trade-offs.
Okay. All right. I'm going to change focus here and talk about some faculty involvement.
Okay.
Okay. What kind of relationship did or do you think the faculty members share with the administration? Do you think that they have any say in the administration of the college? Or, you know, have they over time?
It's really varied from time to time. When I started here, we did something called four-square evaluation, where everybody evaluated everybody below them in the flow chart and everybody above them, so that every library staff member evaluated the library director, evaluated the vice president that the library director reported to. I'm not sure if everybody has always evaluated the president, but we evaluated the vice presidents in days like that. That's something that's really been lost. We don't offer as much input into other people's jobs. I was here when there was a period of time when we were under constant spending freezes. We hadn't had a raise for a while. Relationship between the faculty and the president was deteriorating, and we brought in an AUP chapter and voted to unionize. My personal belief is that the advent of the AUP is the strongest thing that has ever impacted the quality here at Cincinnati State. I think AUP has been a quality effort all along. There's nobody who knows more about what should go on in a classroom than a classroom teacher. And the AUP has tried to increase that role. Administration has tried to make the faculty role lesser and lesser. There have been times when the relationship between the two have been more congenial. There have been times when they've been more adversarial. We were on strike this past fall for the first time ever, something that we all sincerely hoped it would never come to. But the administration, the Board of Trustees, just weren't giving the faculty any respect at all at that time. And that's been really, unfortunately, presidents come in talking a good game. This is the best place. I was so excited to come here because you all do things right. And then immediately telling us what we did wrong and trashing our history, trashing our anything good that we were bringing to the plate. I sincerely believe that the AUP was absolutely the best thing that's happened to ensure quality here.
Okay. Discuss the formation of Faculty Senate in the early 80s. What role do you feel Faculty Senate has played in decisions at the college over the years?
There's always been some form of Faculty Senate. There have been years when it's been very active. There have been years when it's been very minor. I mean, there have been years when, you know, Faculty Senate argued more about water fountains in the halls than anything else. The AUP contract gives the Faculty Senate more teeth than it's ever had before. I think we have a wonderful Faculty Senate that's representative of the whole institution. It's been one of those places where we have the cross-departmental thing, each department, engineering, business, sciences, humanities, the library and counseling have always been considered one unit for those kinds of things. Elect a person. Also through Faculty Senate, you elect your representative to the sabbatical and the tenure committee. The Faculty Senate, the only committees that are actually spelled out in the AAUP committee are APPA, Academic Policies and Curriculum Committee, APCC, and the other one's just lost my mind. But committees that work very diligently at, you know, instilling quality at every level of the college.
Okay. Describe your role in the movement to unionize the faculty in the late 1980s. What rewards and challenges have resulted from the faculty union? I know you've already talked a little bit about this.
Yeah, I was one of the first people who brought an AAUP chapter to campus. In those days, our initial goal in getting an AAUP chapter was simply to vote no confidence in the president and move on. And so actually it was the generation a little bit after us that started the union method. I wasn't actually part of the real movement to get us to become a collective bargaining group, but I've always been very active in the union. I've been on several collective bargaining teams. I've been on the AAUP exec. I would say I was certainly instrumental in bringing the AAUP here, but I wouldn't want to claim credit for getting the union effort, because that was certainly a different group of individuals who had my utmost respect and gratitude.
Okay. Did you want to say any more about rewards and challenges that have resulted from the faculty
union? From the faculty union? There have been rewards. You know, I talked about how when I came in, we did the four-square evaluation of everybody, and then evaluation. The union has really fought to keep the evaluation of the administration. The administrators have always fought against it. And even when there's not been a formal stipulation that the faculty will review the president and the academic vice president, the union's always done that and presented that information to the board whether they wanted it or not. If boards would have listened to the faculty sooner about when a president's time to go had come, I think that many things here would have gone much smoother. We've had many presidents longer than we should have. Everybody comes in great, but, you know, the board, I really would like the board to have more respect for the faculty. I don't know what you can do that, but, you know, we're not the bad guys. I mean, we're really here to ensure what's best for our students and to keep the college alive. And the sooner the board would come to realize that, the better off everybody's going to be. There have been other things. In the old days, before the union, we had a program whereby people who had accumulated a lot of sick leave could donate sick leave to people who needed it. Maybe, you know, a brand new employee hasn't been here very long and all of a sudden has a problem pregnancy and needs bed rest for a long period of time, or, you know, a young faculty member who hasn't had time to build up a lot of sick leave gets cancer and starts using sick leave. And then that program was here for a while and then it just kind of faded away, and the union brought that back. It never would have come back without the union fighting to bring it back.
I'm
sure there are other examples.
Yeah. Okay. How would you describe your relations with other faculty members? Because you are a faculty member, but we're a little bit removed from the teaching faculty.
Yeah, but I think because of the way we do faculty senate, because of the way we do tenure and sabbatical, and because of the union, that I think I have a greater opportunity to interact with faculty as a peer than a lot of librarians. It's real typical for librarians to be faculty, but I don't think it's as typical for them to have a lot of the close relationships that we have here. And the fact that, you know, when I started, we were all so small and everybody knew everybody. We're getting away from that still. But I think that I've always been active in the union. I was one of the co-chairs of the strike this past time. And I think that, you know, any way that you can meet a faculty member is not only for your good, but the library's good. I really would encourage, I'm leaving notes for my successor, and I'm already calling people that I talk to and saying, you know, when this new person comes, call him or her and take him out to lunch. You know, you need to get this person involved from the beginning. It doesn't do anybody any good if the librarian stays inside the library all the time. But I've been nominated. I've never won, but I've been nominated for the House Bruckman Award for Faculty Excellence a couple of times, and that's always a thrill to know that your peers think of you like that.
Okay. Discuss some of the other faculty committees you've been on over the years and any important contributions these committees have played in the direction of the college.
Well, I think I want to go back to accreditation plans. Cincinnati State is accredited by the North Central Association. When I first came in 1980, we were preparing the self-study. Accreditation has changed dramatically over the years. In the early days, there were all these committees would talk about this, these committees would talk about this, and you would make a self-study document that was like 4 inches thick or something like that. And I came in as a brand new hire in 1980 and immediately was on a committee to start doing part of this self-study work. I think, you know, we talk about involving more people, and I just don't see it. I mean, I think the accreditation now that's supposed to be this totally bottom-up driven thing is more top driven than it was in the old days. But there have been many different versions of accreditation, but always a role for anybody who wants to get involved, either, you know, as a formal part of the library doing the kind of research that you do, or, you know, just as your own talents that you bring to it. I've been involved in a lot of accreditation for different programs besides our North Central accreditation. All the health things are accredited by the health organization for their particular specialty, respiratory care, surgical tech, whatever. And I've always helped them with their things. I've been on both the tenure and sabbatical committees. The way we do tenure here now is that the tenure candidates have to submit a portfolio showing what their contributions have been to the college, what their contributions have been to their profession, what their contributions have been to their community, how they're evaluated by their students, their peers, their supervisors. And in a lot of places, like the librarians supervise the library tenure, the nursing faculty supervise the nursing. Here, it's that representative. So there's a librarian or counselor on that committee, as well as somebody from engineering, technology, somebody from business, somebody from science, somebody from humanities, who all vote then on the tenure from people all over the building too. I've been on that committee. I'm just finishing up a stint on the sabbatical committee. Again, our sabbaticals are competitive building-wide. You have a certain amount of sabbaticals, and whoever has a project that they want writes up what they intend to do, how much time it's going to take them, and then this committee that's representative of the different areas votes on which ones to support and send it to the vice president, who then sends it to the board, and the board ultimately awards tenure or sabbatical. But that's where it starts with the faculty committees. I've been active in lots of different things. I've been on Faculty Senate. I've been on the AUP exec. There have been little committees for this, that, and the other. I mean, a lot of times they get together an ad hoc committee for this particular project. I've served on numerous committees over the years. We had a time when we had this Quality Circle thing. We had, I was on the one for teaching and learning. We spent, you know, we met regularly for months and months and months, supported our, sent our proposals on to the presidents, and then they'd like die in a pile on his desk. I mean, absolutely nothing came from that whole wasted year, and things like that can be quite frustrating. I mean, sometimes the administration mouth support for a program that they really don't attach their hearts to.
Okay. On that note, let's change focus and talk about college leadership. What is your perception of the various administrations under which you've served at the college?
I don't know what to say about that. I've worked here for, Fred Schlum was president when I came. He was succeeded by James Long, who was succeeded by Sister Jean Patrice in an interim job between Fred Schlum and Jim Long. There was, all the vice presidents were running it as a foursome. She was succeeded by Ron Wright, who was succeeded by Dr. Henderson, who came in on a temporary basis for a really long time. And now Dr. Odell Owens has been here for about a year and a half. What's frustrating is everybody always comes in saying, this is such a dynamite institution, I just can't wait to start working here, you all do things right. And then it seems like the next week they're telling us what we do wrong and just throwing out the baby with the bathwater. We have reinvented the wheel so many times here. It seems one thing that's been really frustrating, and some people do this more than others, but one thing that's been very frustrating is that it seems like a lot of times an administration has put in a new program without even taking the time to see what it is that they're replacing, and taking time to see whether that really needs to be replaced or not. I would have good things to say about everybody who's worked here, and I'd have negative things to say about everybody who's worked here. I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay. All right. What are your memories of some of the major events that have taken place during your time here at Cincinnati State? What are some of the major events that you think?
When Al Gore was vice president, he came to visit us. That was a big deal. Unfortunately, the Secret Service men managed to turn off the internet accidentally when they were, you know, doing their security checks, and we found out later that that's what it was, which is really ironic since Al Gore did more than anybody else. I mean, you know, he didn't invent the internet, but he certainly did get it to the prominence that it has. He did more than anybody else to get the internet where it is now, to get everybody using it. That was exciting. I mean, I didn't see Al Gore here, but, you know, he was here. We were written up in the Wall Street Journal. We've had national exposure for our co-op programs, especially. Mrs. Biden, Dr. Biden, the vice president's wife, was here like just about a month or so ago. I remember when the health building was built, and we, you know, celebrated that whole new bringing, you know, having new labs, and that was the first major construction here in Cincinnati State's history. I remember when the nursing program, we've always had health technologies, but we acquired somewhere along the line the nursing faculty that had been a hospital-based nursing program, and then they came here. We got an airport. We always had a hangar here. The aviation department would get a plane up to where they turn the motor on, but that's as far as they went because they didn't even have any place to taxi. Mm-hmm. And then we acquired an airport. We built the ATLC. The Midwest Culinary Institute went from being a small, dinky little hole-in-the-wall cooking program to being, you know, a really prestigious deal. There's always been a student-run restaurant here. When I came, it was up on the third floor, right around the corner from what was then the main cafeteria. The restaurant was called the Stateroom. And it was pretty much like a trucker's blue plate special. You could buy like a 85-cent hamburger and a hot dog and a bowl of soup in the blue plate lunch of the day. You just had to call and make a reservation. Students ate there. You know, people, you know, it was just another option for lunch as opposed to the cafeteria. And then they hired new culinary faculty who were coming with more expertise, more, you know, more high-end culinary skills. And then they had a student restaurant called the Continental Room, which was still, when we just had the one building here, they had a set plate, you know, I think it was $6 when they stopped here, and you got your appetizer, your meal, your dessert, all for that one price. They would say, you know, we're taking reservations on these days, and you would have to make your phone call immediately to see when you could get a table. They would sell out like the first day. And then they have the Summit Restaurant, which is open more, and we have still the lunches that are primarily the student labs, but then they have the Summit Restaurant open at other times more as a money-making enterprise. But that's been a really major change, just to see how that one program has grown and changed and improved. But lots of things have happened like that. There have been lots of growth. I mean, when we became a technical college, a community college instead of just a technical college, we've had lots to celebrate here at Cincinnati State. We've had, when I started, we used to graduate in the fall. Was always at Music Hall, like the last Sunday in September or something like that. And we had a period when graduation's been moved to summer, I guess, since we've been a community college. We had a time when they were held under allegedly air-conditioned tents on campus. That space isn't there anymore. The last few have been at the convention center downtown. But they've been, you know, different spaces rented at different times for graduation. It's really been another thing that's really changed a lot over the years.
Okay.
I've seen lots of things come and go.
All right. Let's just talk a little bit about your legacy. What do you feel is your greatest accomplishment here at Cincinnati State?
I feel like I've got a lot to be really proud of. I mean, I really feel like I'm leaving the library a better place than I found it. As I said earlier, the way the library instruction is integrated into the English composition classes is the envy of librarians in lots of other places. I mean, that's really something to be proud of. I'm really proud of having brought the website to the college. I'm really proud of the collection that I've built. I'm really happy with the staff that I'm leaving here. I mean, I didn't hire them. I, you know, helped hiring some of those people, but I really feel like, the library is on the right path. I wish that eventually it would get all the space back that it was supposed to have for, you know, a library a fifth of its size with a fifth of the students. I would hope that eventually the library would be even bigger and better. But, you know, I feel good about where we're leaving us.
Okay.
I feel good about the AUP. I feel good about the faculty in general.
Okay. If you were writing the history of the college, what would you include from your years here?
I just hit about on a lot of the highlights just a minute ago when I talked about the nursing program coming, the expansion of the culinary program, the building thing. Way back I talked about how this original building used to be have more open spaces that they filled in with classrooms, filling in what, you know, had been like a little courtyard between two wings. I've seen a lot of construction. Lots of changes. I mean, it's not the same world as it was in 1980, and the college and the library certainly reflect that.
Mm-hmm. You think we're better off today than we were back then?
There's always challenges and successes in anything. I mean, if I was going to be a student, I would certainly want to be a student in today's library rather than the ones that I was a student in and the one that was here when I got here. I mean, because of the, you know, so much information that's right there on your desktop wherever you may be 24 hours a day, you don't have to wait for the library to open. I think the online access to information is only going to get better. I hope Cincinnati State, I mean, you know, we had a visiting team from one of the programs later, and you were talking about because we're small. And one of the guys looked at us and says, everybody's been saying because you're so small, but you're the second biggest college in Cincinnati. I mean, we're bigger than Xavier now, I think. And we're really not small, but we still have that small college feel because most of our rooms don't hold 30 students. Most of your classes are still small. And I would certainly hope that we never lose that. I hope we never get to the point where we've got 500-seat lecture halls and we have, you know, everybody taking online classes where, you know, an online instructor is supposed to be responsible for 100 students or something like that. I hope we never get to that point. I hope we never lose the hands-on touch that's been our hallmark.
Okay. Last question. Is there anything else that you would like to add or comment on from any previous questions?
I might, after I hear the tape of it. I can't think of anything else I'd like to get into, but...
Okay. Well, we
sprawled kind of, and
okay.
But
well, thanks.
I think this is an exciting project that you're doing. I think I'm case one of the oral histories, and I hope that there are a lot of them, because we have lost so much of our history by not recording it. I mean, you know how you've got these boxes and boxes and boxes of slides that don't even have captions. I think this is a remarkable project that you're undertaking, and there are an awful lot of people this year getting ready to retire, and I really wish you a lot of success with this project.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye.